You are listening to a session recorded live at the American Society of Safety Engineers, Safety 2009, held June 28th through July 1st in San Antonio, Texas. Now to our session.
My name is Chad Burns. I'll be your moderator for today's session. Session entitled Rescue Plan Development, the next step in your managed fall protection program. Before we begin, we'd like to take care of a few housekeeping items. First, we ask that you please complete your session evaluation forms. There's a box at the back of the room where you may drop that on your way out. It's very important that we have your feedback, so please remember to do so. In case of an emergency, an audible and or visual alarm will sound. We ask that you evacuate the room in an orderly fashion and go directly to your nearest exit. You will remain there until the all clear signal has sounded. Please note that smoking is not allowed. Hopefully everybody already knows that. And please take your time at this moment to put all of your pages and your cell phones in silent mode, if you've not already done so. This is just a brief description of this session. Organizations that employ workers at height have an obligation to prepare effectively for rescue in the event that a worker is suspended by an arrest system or becomes incapacitated. This presentation offers simple, effective guidelines for evaluating rescue needs and making appropriate preparation in advance. This session is a follow-up to a session presented at the 2008 PDC and contains additional information and more advanced insights and direction. Now a bit about our speaker. I introduce to you Louis McCurley. Louis is the executive in charge of marketing and technical development for the manufacturing and distribution of life safety products for rescue and work at height. She holds numerous certifications, including technical rescue specialist, rope access technician 1, outdoor emergency care, and technical rescue instructor. Also, it's been a contributing author to numerous articles and publications, including books. Three I will mention: High Angle Rescue Techniques, Wilderness Medicine, and Advanced Rescue Technology. Louis McCurley is Vice President of Vertical Rescue Solutions by Pigeon Mountain Industries, from Wheat Ridge, Colorado. Please join me in welcoming Louis.
Thank you. Thanks very much. I really want to make today's session fairly interactive. Obviously we're going to talk about falls and rescue after a fall, but I figure that as we go through the program today, there's some of the things that I'm going to say that are going to mean more to you than some of the other things I'm going to say. So don't hesitate to slow me down at those points. Raise your hand and ask a question during the course of the conversation, because sometimes it's a lot easier to answer those questions and to discuss those questions together if we can land on the slide or address it in the middle of the discussion where the question came up. To add a little bit to what's already been said, I should let you know that I do not come to this from a fall protection background. I come to this from a rescue background. I've worked in rescue since about 1985, and that has varied from two different fire departments to a mountain rescue team in Colorado, and also to the industrial environment where I now teach industrial rescue and work for a company that also makes equipment that's used for industrial and all types of high angle rescue. There's the second slide here. We're just going to skip past really quickly because it has a little video on it, and the video is not playing correctly. This is a flash presentation, and so it's a little bit different than a PowerPoint. And my clicker here is kind of a the first one. Let's see. Yeah, the first one you have to click through right here, and. There, and then from here on out, all you really have to do is hit the space bar. So, 8 seconds. Okay. So we'll skip through that one for now and you can just hit the space bar. So as we all know, and probably part of the reason you're here, is that falls kill a lot of people every year. And falls cost all of our businesses and our economy a lot of money every year. In fact, they account for over 12% of all of our occupational injuries. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that all of those falls are from heights. Some of them are slips and trips and that kind of thing. But in general, falls are a bad thing, and they cost employers about $6 billion a year. How many of you guys deal in industries where you have falls happening on a regular, not on a regular basis, I'm sorry, fall potential happening? How many of you guys have people working at heights? Now, keep your hands up. How many of you guys do not presently have a post-fall rescue plan? About half the room. And that's not surprising, and I appreciate your honesty. You guys are not alone. In fact, that's a much lower percentage than I expected based on previous conversations and the work that I do. Most of the people who have people working at height, most companies who have people at height, the main response plan that they have is, as Gordon up here and I were discussing just a moment ago, is dial 911. 911 is not a rescue plan. We'll discuss more of that later. Falls has continued to be one of OSHA's top three priorities for several years. And in the last few years, or 2 years, I suppose, rescue after a fall has also risen to the top of the pot as being an area of concern. So, an example of some of the falls that have actually happened in work at height, this is an incident that happened in Green Bay, Wisconsin. This fall happened on a construction site, and fortunately, the guy was wearing fall protection. That was a good thing. Fortunately, they didn't have unfortunately, they didn't have a rescue plan in place, but they managed to rescue him and managed to figure it out. About 2 weeks later, the same exact fall happened again. This time they had a rescue plan in place and things went much more smoothly. Another fall that recently happened at height was on this building where two men were working on a scaffold or a platform, and one of the men wasn't wearing a harness and one of the men was. One lived, one died. The one that lived actually hung there for quite a while while he was waiting for rescue, which again isn't all that uncommon. Another incident that recently happened, this is this month, guys. This is an incident that happened on June 17th. A 21-year-old man died when he fell about 40 feet in Grand Rapids. Why he fell, no one's quite sure at this point. The report hasn't come out yet, but he was wearing a harness. This one was in Boynton Beach, Florida, and the scaffold fell, and their harness was caught. And again, they didn't have a rescue plan in place, so they were left hanging for a while before they were able to get in. And in this case, the emergency procedure eventually was to break a window and drag them in through the window. Most of the time when you see falls at height, you'll find that the OSHA report looks something like this. It talks about the weather conditions. In this case, it says clear. Well, in many cases, it's clear. In many cases, weather wasn't necessarily a factor. Size of work crew, we don't know, collective bargaining, no. The competent safety monitor was on site. There was a safety and health program in effect. And the work site was inspected regularly. So, in many cases, they were doing a lot of things right. So people still die in work at height. And this was a situation that happened actually earlier this month as well. This is a power worker. And this particular power worker had worked at height for a very long time and was very skilled in his job and fell to his death despite wearing fall protection equipment. Tower erectors and climbers, in fact, top the list and have for the last few years as the most dangerous occupations. And you'll see that some of those other things in there, like structural iron and steel workers, probably don't surprise you, electrical power line, roofers. I don't know what your industry is, but anytime anybody's looking at height, there's a hazard for a fall. But what about after the fall? After the fall is often ignored by most of us who have people working at height. According to good practice, we not only have to have a safety plan in place, a fall protection plan in place, but we need to have a post-fall rescue plan. Our post-fall rescue plan needs to have two components. Most of our post-fall rescue plan has one component, and that component is the external 911. What it really needs to have is an internal plan, which we're going to go into detail here in a moment, and an external liaison. That means you don't just dial 911, but you call 911 well in advance and work with your emergency services to determine whether they know how to get to you, make sure they can get onto your plant and to the right building in a timely fashion, and that they have the equipment, the techniques, and the training to get into the environment that your fallen worker might be in once they finally get there. In terms of regulation, you guys probably know as well as I do what the regulations are. I actually work a little bit with the NCG-359 committee. I sit on that committee and have for more than 10 years. And one of our focuses in that committee has been to try to streamline and simplify fall protection planning for you guys. Because if it's a bunch of regulations and a great big giant book, it doesn't do anybody any good. You guys have to be able to read that and implement it in a simple, effective fashion in order for it to work for you. Well, we're taking the same process with the rescue side of things. So regardless of what OSHA regulation you fall under, safety is really your most important concern. That's really what we're all after, is safety. So when it comes to safety at height, I like to think of things in terms of two main aspects. One being vision. And most of you guys, how many of you guys are the administrators in charge of your program, your rescue program? Okay, so a few people in here are that. That's your visionary. That's the person who creates the big picture vision and says, here's how things are really going to look, and here's how things are really going to work in this business. In vision, you talk about whether you're going to use fall restraint, fall arrest, positioning, rope access. How are you going to do this job in the most effective and safe manner? The preparation is your comprehensive managed fall protection program. Anybody ever heard that term before? The comprehensive managed fall protection program. Think about every one of those words. They each mean something, and they're each very, very important. But really, those two things, the targeted, focused vision, and then the simple, elegant solution to make it happen, are what make up your safety. The answer is E359.1. Does anybody fall under E359.1? Few people? Okay, several people. The NCG-359.1 used to be an equipment standard. The NCG-359.1 is no longer, well, it is still an equipment standard, but there is an entire NCG-359 family of standards now. And that family of standards provides way more guidance than .1 ever did. Again, .1 is a manufacturing standard, and it talks about equipment. But it was originally published in 1992, and again in 1999, and it didn't really address anything but the gear. So when the new Z69 family of standards came out in 2007, they added chassis. They added a .2 that is an entire document discussing minimum requirements for a comprehensive managed fall protection program. It's a guidebook. It's exactly what it is. It takes that Z359.1 and puts it into practical terms of how to implement it. Z359.3 is safety requirements for travel and restraint systems. So exactly the same as .1, but not for fall arrest. It's for restraint systems. And Z359.4 is safety requirements for assisted rescue and self-rescue systems, subsystems, and components. So we're addressing rescue now. Rescue is also addressed in .2. So as you're going through this comprehensive managed fall protection program document, which is an incredible resource, it really guides you through setting up your entire safety plan, including the rescue side of things, it refers to .4. So those are the two that I like to work with when I'm working on a rescue plan. The bottom line is that wherever fall protection is used, rescue has to be used alongside it. This is an accident that happened quite some time ago, actually, several years ago now. This is a guy who was actually working in a harness with a seat board. And when you're working in a harness, often the seat board is really just used almost like a suspended scaffold. It's almost just a comfort seat. It's really not intended to be your safety system. So there's a safety system in addition to that. It's then slipped off of the safety, off of the seat board into the safety system and expired while waiting for rescue. I wish I could tell you that this is an unusual occurrence. This happens all too often. We've got sign installers that the same thing has happened. We have other building maintenance people where the same thing has happened. We have truck loaders where the same thing has happened. The list goes on. They're often not all that easy to find because they're buried in other reporting systems, but that's another talk and another subject. The other thing that's contributing to this, this is from USA Today about a week ago, fire departments all over the country are cutting services. And when they're cutting services, that means they're cutting people. And they're cutting capability. So if fire departments in your area cut capability, it's your responsibility as the employer to make sure that your needs are covered when it comes to rescue. This is in, again this month, a situation where the rescue team and the local rescue responders obviously hadn't had a lot of pre-coordination with the incident, or the potential incidents that might happen at this facility. In this situation, a gentleman, this would be listed as a chemical incident. It wouldn't be listed as a fall incident, even though it really was. You'll find it in the recording under chemical incidents. In this situation, somebody went down because of a chemical, ended up inside of a tank, and before it was over, several people were hospitalized. This happened day before yesterday, I believe, in New York. You may have seen the headlines. That was a little longer than day before yesterday, but it wasn't long ago. An Otis elevator technician was trying to rescue people stuck in an elevator in New York City, and he ended up plunging to his death because he wasn't trained in rescue. He was an elevator technician, so the rescue plan wasn't in place. They had already been in there for 3 or 4 hours. What does that tell you? It tells you the people who did respond to the rescue, the fire department, weren't prepared to do anything about it. The pre-plan was not in place. This is a happier situation that happened on that same day or the day before in a construction situation. We all know that construction has kind of a bad rap and that people often have a perception that construction workers are not necessarily well protected. I'd like to say that that's not necessarily true, and it's changing in the construction industry where people are not only prepared for a fall, but they're prepared to rescue somebody after a fall. In this situation, this is a company that is being very open and sharing their fall incidents in an effort to help other construction companies understand that communication and training and preparation is a good thing. And a week or so ago, they had their fourth save as a result of using fall protection equipment, and in all situations, they had rescue in less than 10 minutes. And granted, rescue doesn't have to be fancy. It can be a bucket truck. It can be a ladder. It just needs to be a plan to get people out of the situation that they're in. Rescue in the workplace is often compliance-driven. Compliance-driven rescue is good because you've got to be compliant. We all know that. But often it has a bit of a CYA mindset. It often is intended to keep you from getting fined, not necessarily to protect the worker. And it's also often reactive. You wait until an accident happens, and then you say, oh, yeah, to be prepared for that in the future. Safety-driven rescue has a little bit different philosophy. So safety-driven rescue is based on industry best practice, and it considers the potential for an incident to happen and then responds to that potential. And I'm a big believer in very simple, elegant solutions. I'm a believer in systems that don't require a lot of training, a lot of maintenance, to upkeep. And the reason for that is because most of the time, the people who are doing rescue on site are going to be workers who are working at height on a regular basis. You're not going to have a rescue team that's just standing by waiting for something to happen. Stuff doesn't happen that often. So the systems and the concepts and the philosophies that you use need to be simple enough that you can train these guys, and then they can stay trained without having to retrain every 3 weeks, right? These guys have real jobs, and that's really what you need them to spend their time doing. Again, ANSI G359.2 is minimum requirements for the Comprehensive Fall Protection Program, and again, it provides guidelines for setting up your rescue system in exactly this manner. These are the key elements of your rescue plan. Your site rescue plan should be a written pre-plan. Okay? Your site rescue plan needs to be a simple, effective, or employ a simple, effective rescue system. It needs to ensure that you have properly trained personnel, and you need to make sure that you've coordinated with a local municipal agency. I'm not in any way suggesting that you should bag the local agency. They always need to be, well, you do need to dial 911. You just need to not stop there. So, your site rescue plan is a written plan that uses very simple, very straightforward system that trains your people effectively, and it encourages the liaison with the external resources as well. The main thing is that your rescue plan should follow on your job hazard analysis. Everybody got job hazard or job safety analysis? Good. So if you've got a job safety analysis, you've got the foundation in your rescue plan. That's where your rescue plan starts. You've already identified the potential incidents, and you've already identified what to do to potentially mitigate those kinds of things. The next step is simply to think about, okay, despite my mitigation, what if it doesn't? Then what? So you've got it in place already. In addition to following on your job hazard and job safety analysis, your rescue plan should consider patient care. So what kind of care is that patient going to need if that fall does happen? It'll identify your response plan to the incident. It'll identify what each person's responsibility is, the rescue methods that they'll use, the specific equipment that they'll use, other resources that might be open to you if that doesn't work, or even if that does work, what's your next level of response? And then it'll establish a rescue training program. When I go into a camp and I write a rescue program, when I write a rescue plan, this is exactly what I do. Any one of you guys could sit down and do the exact same thing tomorrow. You go through this whole list and you just fill out. You just embellish on each and every one of those. It takes some thought, it takes some time, but this is a simplified version of what your rescue plan should look like. So, let's start with the job hazard analysis. The job hazard analysis already defines your area of responsibility. It already identifies an area of workplace and the scope of the people who you're covering. It already identifies the known or foreseeable hazards. So that's pretty straightforward. The second element, the fall rescue plan. For each hazard, you have to develop a self-rescue protocol, an assisted rescue protocol, and an external response protocol. So it's sort of a stair-step concept. If you fall while you're using a harness, here's what you should do. And I'm going to train you to do that. That's step number one. So everybody working at height should be able to get themselves out of a fall predicament if a fall happens. And if they can't quite get out of it, they should at least be able to get themselves into a position of comfort. Secondly, what do their buddies do? What's our assisted response protocol? In some cases, it's just kind of crank. I mean, in some cases, it's very simple. In other cases, it's put a ladder up against the wall so they can reach and get up and get out of their system. In other cases, it might be getting a bucket truck from across the yard. In some situations, you might have to employ rope techniques and high-angle type rescue techniques, but even those don't have to be overly complicated. And whenever you initiate an in-house rescue response, you should also simultaneously initiate your external response. So do dial 911 and then go start your rescue. Does anybody know, how many people use front attachment points here? Does anybody use front attachment points to fall arrest? Are front attachment points allowed for fall arrest?
Ladder.
Historically, you are absolutely correct. There is a move, however, towards allowing the front attachment point for what we call limited fall arrest. And the ANSI Z359 actually addresses this. The ANSI Z359 actually says if your fall distance is limited to 2 feet or less, and if your force potential is limited to 900 pounds or less, then a front attachment point is okay. And yes, ladders is the absolute primary place where that is used. It's also used in rope access. It's also used in other positioning type fall protection work where you can't get a big fall. The reason that was done is largely because there have been incidents that have happened because people who are moving in and out of fall arrest on a regular basis, you can't reach back here. And you can't monitor your own site back, your own harness back here. Up here you can't. There's actually a guy 2.5 years ago who fell to his death because he was incorrectly rigged back here. Because when he rigged himself back in after moving back into place, he didn't have somebody on the structure that he was on to double check him, and guess what? He didn't do it right. So that frontal attachment point is permitted. Where you say, well, ANSI's not OSHA. You're right, ANSI's not OSHA. But OSHA does say that where a standard that they reference has been updated, they go with the newer revision of that. And so the newer revision of ANSI Z359 says frontal attachment point okay for 900 pounds force and 2 foot free fall. Okay? Yes, sir. Thank you. Sternal. Thank you for bringing that up. I should have mentioned that. Chest. So sternal. The waist attachment point is not allowed. So the waist attachment point is not acceptable. It has to be sternal. Why is this important? Well, actually, you're a good segue into one of the things that I'd like to talk about, and that is that I would like for the waist attachment point to be acceptable. And that's because when we have an upper attachment, where the top or bottom, the upper attachment, when you fall in a head-down position, typically. And when you have an attachment at one end of your body or the other, the whiplash effect is amazing. Whereas if the closer your attachment point is to the center of gravity, the more your body kind of teeter-totters around itself and dissipates the force. Yes, sir? Ladders are different. Ladders are different. So when you have a ladder system and things are designed around that ladder system, anybody know the standard? Anybody know the reg? I don't know it off the top of my head. Yes, you can. But not for limited fall arrest. Not for the 900-pound force. Not for the 2 foot free fall. So. Right. So the point is being made that we're talking fall restraint here, not fall arrest. So the thing that I'm talking about is fall arrest, whereas fall restraint has different rules. And in fall restraint, you can attach to hip points, you can attach to anything on the harness that's actually designed for that to do positioning, but you never, ever, ever need to be in a position where you could potentially fall. Does that make sense? Well, look at this video here. This is what happens during a fall. This is actually just a drop test. And it uses a dummy for the test. So that's what happens during a fall. And we're going to see that in slow motion here in a second. But when the body falls, it tends to fall in an upright, in a head-down position. And then the body wants to right itself around that position. So there's a lot of violence there in that fall. But he got caught. He's in bad shape, isn't he? So when the body tries to right itself around that attachment point, it's a very violent experience. Has anybody ever actually fallen in a fall arrest harness? Sometimes people have their guys, and this is a really good practice. have the guys actually step off of a ladder and take a short fall, just so you know what it feels like when you do impact. The point that I'm trying to make here is that when somebody takes a fall, if they take a real fall, like a 6-foot fall with a lanyard and it deploys and all of that, and you got 1,800 pounds force going on the guy, he's going to be a hurting unit. It's not like you just brush that off and say, oh, I'll just work again. That's a significant incident. So you need to think about medical care. Just doing the fancy part of, oh, let's turn the crank and get the guy out of his predicament, or let's send a guy down to rescue him. That's all well and good, but we need to have some medical preparation as well. Anybody ever heard of suspension trauma? Who knows about suspension trauma? Wow. Every time I talk to a group of people, it seems like the group gets bigger that understands what suspension trauma is. I prefer to call it suspension intolerance, because really, it's not a traumatic experience. It's more an intolerance to prolonged exposure. It's just suspension intolerance. The concept behind it is that when you hang in a harness long enough, you become more or less incapacitated. That happens when you are motionless in that harness. So you say, well, I can sit in a harness for hours and work and do my painting and whatever. Yeah, you can, because you're moving around, your legs are moving, your arms are moving, you're in motion, you're fine. What happens in a fall, when that big violent incident happens and people get hurt and they're hanging there, well, if they've suffered a medical condition or if they've suffered physical trauma as a result of the fall, they're left hanging in the rear attachment point like this. Well, what happens when you're hanging like this is all of your blood goes where? South. And your diaphragm is what? Compressed. And your tongue is where? Shifted forward. Everything is not in that nice position that you learned about in EMT or first aid school about breathing. You know how to get somebody breathing? Well, it's not to position them like this. It's to position them in a wide open type position, and they need to get their legs up, and they need to put their feet up in the soft position, and all. Well, that's not where you're positioned in a harness. So in a period of 5 to 10 to 15 minutes, people can actually suffer long-term effects and can actually die. So you do need to get people out of their system. You do need to get people into a position of comfort as quickly as possible, and hopefully off their system as quickly as possible, as long as you can do that safely. Question? Great idea. Absolutely. Those are phenomenal. And there's a lot of people marketing that kind of stuff right now. In fact, NIOSH came out with a test a year or two ago where they're trying to promote the concept of a strap that automatically, if you take a fall, flips your legs up and comes up behind your knees so that you're left kind of in a seated position. I'm not sure what that would do to your back or in the rest of the fall, but the concept is get those feet up. The thing to keep in mind when you're working with, if you're looking at harnesses or systems that have the self-deployable stirrups to stand in, one of the things to keep in mind is some of them are actually on the harness. Well, I don't know if you've ever, guys, many guys wear dresses, but I'll tell you, when you put on a dress and you step on the bottom of it and try to stand up, it doesn't work. If you're wearing your harness and you step in a stirrup that's attached to your harness, what are you going to do? You're going to just fold yourself in half. So the thing needs to be attached up on the system. It needs to be attached at the fall arrestor. It needs to be attached on the line. You somehow have to get it off the harness and into an upper position where you can actually use it. Does that make sense? Because otherwise all you're doing is going like this, and that kind of compounds the problem. It doesn't really resolve it.
So,
that's an excellent point, Gordon. In fact, the whole concept of suspension intolerance is really nothing more than orthostatic intolerance. And I find that if you put your feet up on the seat in front of you, it really helps out a whole lot. So in your response plan, some of the other things that you need to think about are your notification of when an incident happens. How do you know that somebody has fallen? There was an incident, well, if somebody doesn't know that the incident happened, nobody can respond to it. And if the guy is hanging there turtled and he can't respond to it either, then that's a problem. So what's the best way to make sure that somebody knows that something has happened? Never work alone. That's a really good idea. Never work alone. In some situations, I understand that you know, people say, well, I have no choice. You know, I have to send somebody out alone. It's a budgetary consideration. Yeah, I understand that. But realistically, the cost of sending people out in pairs versus the cost of losing an employee and somebody dying because something bad happened, it's a lot cheaper to send somebody, to send people in pairs. Yes? That's a very good point, Raphael. The point that Raphael just made was that when people are rescued after a fall, and we actually teach this in our classes, when people are rescued after a fall and they've been hanging there for a while and all that blood is pooled, if you suddenly lay that person down and all that toxic blood comes rushing back to all the important parts of your body, the important parts of your body don't really like that, your liver, your heart, don't really like that very much. And people can expire even though they were fine while they were hanging at height. They can expire just from that shock. And so if that happens, what we tell people, what we teach people, is to tell the emergency responders to treat the patient as, because we did dial 911, didn't we? Right? Remember? So we tell them to tell the responders to treat this patient as though they have a crush injury. So a crush injury is another word for compartment syndrome, which is exactly the same thing that happens when people are hanging in a harness. So that's a very, very good, and yeah, I'm not getting into that much detail typically today, but that's a very important point to make when you're working with people at height. Treat that person as though they've had a crush injury. So you have to notify somebody that an incident has happened. We have to make contact with the subject and see if he's well or unwell or likely to be able to help himself in the rescue. We need to secure the area so nobody else gets hurt. We need to initiate the on-site response, so get his buddies responding to him, or whatever your on-site rescue response protocol is, you need to activate that. And then we also need to dial 911. So all those things are really the outline of your response plan. So how are you going to do each and every one of those things? And again, we flesh those things out when we prepare a rescue plan for people. In your response plan, you typically have in-house responders, and you have to have jobs for those in-house responders. Each of them needs to know what they're supposed to do, not just at a management level, but on the ground level, on a practical level. We talk about crisis management, and we talk about emergency response. Can anybody tell me the difference between the two? Crisis management is a big picture thing. Crisis management is what your managers do, okay? That's the long-term effects, and it starts when the incident happens, and it might end 6 months later or 12 years later when the lawsuit's over. Crisis management is a really big picture, and it takes in also into consideration all sorts of stuff. What we're talking here is just the emergency response plan component of that crisis management plan, okay? So the emergency response plan is what happens to resolve the emergency when it happens. And what happens with the lawyers and the long-term care and all of that is outside our scope at this point. But you've got your personnel, so your personnel all have jobs. You have your in-house responders. You have to determine what the other people on site are going to do. Does everybody carry on work as usual? What else happens to make sure that nothing further happens at that particular location? Who's notifying family members? Who's taking care of the psychological trauma of all the other people who are going, did you see that? And who's handling the calmness and the ongoing care of the rest of the employees? And of course, there's always PR considerations. And then most importantly, your external liaison. What I mean by your external liaison is that person who's been talking to the local fire department and has worked out in advance what the plan with them is going to be. And that person should be a couple of people, like a person per shift, And there should be a person assigned to coordinate with that local fire or rescue authority who's responding to your site, so that when the accident's being resolved and your on-site team is doing something and the external guys come in, there's some communication going on between the two. And again, this is just an overview of all of this. This is not, I mean, you can go home and use this information to create your own emergency response plan, but this is not the emergency response plan in its entirety. You need to customize this for your application. Who's responsible for rescue? The employer is responsible for rescue. We like to think that 911 is responsible for rescue, but the employer is responsible for his employees. And it's the employer's responsibility to make sure that his employees are cared for and to mitigate the potential for an incident to occur in the first place, and then to respond to that incident if the incident should happen. So your authority having jurisdiction is, in this case, the employer. This is more about personnel responsibilities. We can just flat pass this one. Your rescue methods. Let's talk about rescue methods for a minute. You remember I said just a minute ago that you have to have three levels of rescue response. You need to have the person who fell, what's their self-rescue capability. The person who's standing next to the guy who fell, what's your in-house rescue capability or your assisted rescue capability. And then thirdly, your external response. Well, in that internal level, where it's the self-rescue or the on-site assisted rescue, there's some considerations as an employer. The main consideration as an employer is, as I said earlier, these guys have real jobs, and their real job isn't to do rescue. And so you don't want to have to spend a lot of time and money getting them up to speed. You don't want to have to teach these guys to put together, you know, 20 carabiners and 4 ropes and 16 pulleys into a rescue system because they're not going to remember it day after tomorrow, much less 6 months from now when something might actually happen. So the rescue methods have to be cost-effective, and they have to be cost-effective not only from a purchasing standpoint, but from a training standpoint, and then an ongoing upkeep of both the equipment and the personnel. They need to be job site specific. What might work in your situation might not work in your situation, and so on and so forth, because you work in different environments. Sometimes you can't go down. Sometimes you can't go up. Sometimes you don't have any anchors. Sometimes you can't pull. Sometimes it just really has to be customized to your application. These methods have to be easy to use and easy to follow, and you really have to ensure maximum potential for success with a limited amount of training. And when you address your training, you need to address frequency of training and the type of training. A lot of times people really enjoy doing the rigging part. You know, they want to use those 15 carabiners and 4 ropes and 16 pulleys, and they want to do that because that's fun. But realistically, the ongoing training for that kind of thing isn't very cost effective. The type of training that they need is simple rescue techniques, but they also need medical training. They also need a certain amount of psychological training to be able to respond to. It's one thing responding to a stranger when something's happened, but it's a whole other thing when you're responding to the guy that you work with every single day and he's taken a whipper. That becomes a whole other thing. So again, simple, elegant solutions in all of those categories. Simple, elegant solutions will get you way farther than having the snazziest stuff on the block. Self-rescue needs to be very simple. It needs to get a person at the very least into a position of comfort and then potentially even out of their system if possible. It needs to be quick. He has to have the equipment on him. And the goal is for him to be able to do this in 5 minutes or less. Why is that? Orthostatic intolerance. Remember what we talked about being turtled like this? In about 5 minutes, even somebody who's very, very fit is pretty uncomfortable, and your air is gone, and your energy is gone, and your muscles are all talking about doing other things, and you just can't effectively self-rescue. So he's got to be able to do this, and he's got to be able to do it quickly. And you see the foot strap that we have on this guy is up high, because again, if it's not coming off of the main system, if it's just on your harness, it's not going to work very well. It's better than nothing, but it's not going to work very well. Assisted rescue is, again, your on-site rescue. Assisted rescue needs to be handled with nearby personnel. If you have six plants in a three-state region and you have a rescue response team at one of them, they're not going to be able to go to the other five to do rescue. You've got to have one on site at the location where the incident might happen. People have to be trained where the accident might happen. The rescue kit has to be nearby. It's amazing. People kind of think, oh, put the rescue kit, we'll just buy one because they're really cheap, they're really expensive, so we'll just buy one and we'll put it up in the office up here, and then if anybody needs it, they can come from anywhere in our 50-acre facility and come and get it. Well, by the time they've come and got it and gone back, it's been 15 or 20 minutes, and it's a little late. So the rescue kit needs to be stationed on-site, which means that you need to think through the care of it. You need to think through what might happen to it while it's hanging there or while it's sitting there waiting to be used. If there's any chemicals in the plant, any damage that might occur, you need to know, the guys need to know where it is, how to use it, and it needs to be taken care of. Again, it needs to be an easy-to-use system. And really, you want people to be able to grab that kit and get back to anywhere where an incident might have occurred in 10 minutes or less. So your initial thing is 5 minutes. The guy who fell needs to be able to take care of himself in 5 minutes or less. And the guys who are responding from all around need to reach him with the equipment that they need in 10 minutes or less. Is that aggressive? That's way aggressive. That is really aggressive. But it can be done, and it doesn't have to be complicated. Again, the more simple and elegant your solution, the more likely you are to be able to pull that off. Professional rescue, standby rescue, the standby rescue teams, anybody use standby rescue teams in here? Sometimes people in confined space environments or other high-risk industries will use a standby rescue team where somebody's literally sitting there doing a crossword puzzle waiting for an accident to happen. Yes, sir. Yes? Mm-hmm. That's a really good plan. The point that's being made is that that he's a municipality, and so he's actually brought the fire department into the assisted rescue portion of the plan, so that he knows that if an accident happens, the fire department's already seen what the potential incidents might be, and they know where to go and what to do, and they're part of that assisted rescue plan. And that works great as long as you know that you can still achieve your timely response even if they're on another call or even if they're on another two or three calls. Because that's what happens obviously in the fire department is that depending on your area, you may have a car accident going on and you may have a medical situation going on in somebody's house and you may have a fire happening. And oh, by the way, we just had an incident happen. So you got to be prepared for that to happen. Yes, sir. That's a very valid point. This gentleman over here has the luxury of being a municipality, so he's like this with his local fire department, but not all of us are like that. And the point that's being made is that many fire departments in the country don't have technical rescue capabilities at all, and their mutual aid or their arrangements that they may have to accommodate that may actually be quite a ways away at another department. Yes, sir. Volunteer, there are more volunteer fire departments in the United States than there are paid fire departments. And a volunteer fire department, volunteer fire departments can be excellent. I mean, those guys train a lot and they're very good at what they do and all of that, but they're not doing it all day every day. They're not at the station when the accident happens, and they don't necessarily have the opportunity or the wherewithal to be able to train in all of the kinds of things that might happen in your plant. You had another comment back in the back? That's a very valid point. The professionalism of volunteer versus paid has nothing to do with it, but the timely response does. And so in a volunteer department, you're going to get a slower response than you are in a paid department. Yes, sir? Absolutely. And again, the fire department shouldn't, the point that was being made was that when it comes to confined space and lockout tagout, it's actually required that you coordinate with your local rescue or with your rescue agency before the incident happens. And that's actually what we're suggesting as well for any type of fall protection. So you'd really better take that initiative in advance to make sure that coordination has happened. So being able to use, there's kind of multiple levels of that external response, though. A standby team is very different from your municipal rescue organization. Those are two very different things. Your standby team is really just a fancy version of your in-house rescue buddy response system. So the professional standby rescue, which is very common in confined space, will occur only where there's a significant potential for the thing to happen or bad things to happen if the thing does happen. So that's not very likely in most situations, but when it does, when it is likely, we use on-site trained personnel with more advanced technical rescue capabilities that are customized to our type of incident. Yes, sir? Yes. Actually, we'll talk about that in just a minute, because there's a lot of variety out there, and there's many, 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 many things that can work. So I like to talk about not specifically items, because items are a dime a dozen. I mean, I work for the training company that I'm with actually works with a manufacturer who has stuff, and there's 20 other companies out there that have stuff. So the stuff doesn't matter nearly as much as the capability. So we're going to talk about that capability here in just a sec. So in municipal external rescue, yeah, got to have team coordination. They may not understand your job site very well, so you've got to make sure that happens. And they should always be considered a backup resource. So first and foremost, you're an inside response capability. Equipment. Equipment is addressed by ANSI Z359.4, equipment for rescue. So this isn't point one. This isn't the equipment for fall protection. This is equipment for rescue, and it is addressed in point four. The equipment that you use or that your site uses for rescue should be compliant with point four. And again, in point two, it outlines the capabilities that you should have. But we're going to go through some of that here. Simple, elegant solutions. Anybody think of a ladder or a bucket as elegant? I do, because it's simple and it's easy to get up to a person when they need it. If you can use a ladder and you've got a ladder on site, by all means, that's the best way to do the rescue. If you're using a more complicated system, you really need something as an anchorage. You probably need some sort of rope. Make sure it's a life safety rope, please. You need a lowering or descent device or something to work as a friction brake on that rope. You may need a raising system, depending on your environment. And you probably need some sort of connectors. Those are all outlined in point four. Again, it needs to be compact, available, effective, and easy to use. We talk about compatibility a lot. Compatibility is incredibly important. When you move from fall protection to the rescue side of the world, not all equipment is necessarily compatible with other equipment. So think in terms of systems. Think in terms of things that you know are supposed to be grouped together, because then there's no question about it. If you start pulling together, well, I like, you know, this rope, and I like this descender, and I like these pulleys, and well, maybe those don't necessarily fit together or work as effectively with one another as they should. So think in terms of systems and work with somebody who has that capability to help you pull that system together so it is compatible. PPE for rescue is very different from PPE for fall arrest. Fall arrest, again, we often have the rear attachment point. In fall arrest, we sometimes aren't even wearing helmets, and when we are, they're often helmets that don't have what we call a three-point suspension system. They just have a little chin strap, and when you're looking at height, it's nothing more than a chin strap. If you go like this, where does your helmet go? So PPE for rescue differs somewhat from PPE for fall protection, and always has frontal attachment points, and may have waist attachment points as well as that sternal attachment point. May even have shoulder attachments and positioning rings and things, depending on the type of situation that you're in. There are many harnesses called rescue harnesses. The harness, the professional rescue is, the equipment is governed largely by the National Fire Protection Association, and their standard is NFPA 1983. but the G369.4 does address that to some degree. It basically says that it needs to be something that meets G369.1, but it also has to have a frontal attachment, which, by the way, is an important thing to have even if you're just working at height. That frontal attachment, even if you're just working at height and may never do a rescue, if you ever need to be rescued or do a self-recovery kind of thing, just having something to attach to up here is incredibly valuable. So the solutions-based approach takes into consideration equipment in terms of systems. So it's not just component, 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 component. It's your entire system. We have multiple kinds of systems. This is a controlled rate descender. Anybody use CRDs in here? Controlled rate descenders are really cool because all you have to do is jump onto the system and it automatically lowers you to the ground. No thinking, no effort, no mistakes, no all. You can get attached to the system and jump, which most people don't. Most people mount the system a little more like this because it's a little disconcerting to just jump. But that system automatically breaks, as in B-R-A-K-E, and slowly lowers you to the ground. Which is okay as long as there's not like a vat of acid or something below you. If you need to come up, that doesn't work very well. If you have multiple people that you need to get off of a platform, that doesn't work very well. So a controlled rate descender is an excellent choice for certain applications, but it does have limitations. It doesn't necessarily work in every situation. It tends to be it does one thing, it does one thing well, and that's all it really does. Jesse. Yes, there are some that will actually lower you after you fall. So you fall and it does the fall arrest and then it slowly lowers you to the ground. Which again, as long as you know that that's what you want to do, it works really, really well. Personal escape descenders. Personal escape is becoming really big now, especially in certain environments where fires can occur, for example, in the shell of a wind turbine or in a structure where people are working in a space where they might need to get out of quickly if something should happen. So this is a personal escape descender type situation. They tend to be manually operated, tend to be carried by the person who's likely to use it. They're a single operation. You can't lift it back up and give it to the next guy. Once somebody uses it, it's at the bottom, and so is he, and so it has a limited application, and that's why people carry them. You see that he's hands-off there. Most of the escape devices that we're looking at these days, and in fact it's mandated by point four, is that if you let go completely, it should stop. And if you pull too hard on the device, if you try to make it go too fast, it should automatically stop. So it's kind of a double safety sort of a system, because we know that the people who are most likely to be using these devices aren't necessarily people who are using them very often. So the potential for misuse of these devices has to be mitigated, and that's how it's done, a double locking mechanism. Does that make sense? When it comes to actually rescuing people, we tend to go with a solutions approach. As I said a minute ago, you want to make sure that whatever system you use, and there's a lot of them out there, you want to make sure that the system is compatible and all the parts of the system are compatible with one another, and it should be as multifunctional as possible so that you don't have a kit over here on this side of the plant for lowering and a kit over here on this side of the plant for raising and a kit over on this side of the plant to do a pickoff. The more multifunctional you are, the better off you're going to be. It is a telescopic pole for reaching down. In fact, we're going to see it used here maybe next. It's a telescopic pole for reaching down and grabbing somebody off of a scaffold, for example. This is a device. Again, there are many of the devices out there that do this, but again, double locking. If you pull too hard or try to go too fast, it should lock. And if you let go, it should lock. And again, this is for people that we understand may not be doing this kind of work every day and sort of mitigates the potential for an accident. So again, we've seen the subject. This is a picture of that pole, actually. When somebody has fallen, the biggest problem is getting to them, so reaching down to them. There are several poles on the market like this that you can just reach down and grab somebody. when you use a pole like this, you need to keep in mind that it needs to stay attached to you somehow, so that if you drop it, it's not gone forever. And the telescoping capability needs to be manageable and easy to use. It needs to be fairly lightweight. And in this case, he has just hooked the hook on the end of his rescue system down to that patient. And then from that point, all he has to do is get the patient off of his system, off of the patient's system. So he can do that either by raising the person up a little bit and unclipping him, or he can do that by cutting the person's system with a pair of scissors. So once he does that, then he can either raise or lower him to safety. So now he's safetied the rescue system, and he's put it as tight as possible, and he'll proceed to get the person off of their system. So getting to the patient is the first most important thing. In this case, he's simply going to lower him to the ground. I believe he's probably in that situation just cut the person's lanyard, and so he's just going to lower him to the ground because the ground's right there. Those are all pre-established anchor points, and that has to be in your rescue plan for every situation where something might happen. Anchor points for rescue have to be 3,000 pounds. Rescue by raise. This is the wrong label on there, but being able to raise somebody out of a situation, if a lowering isn't possible, if you have a vat of acid below, or if it's 450 feet to the ground or whatever it is, being able to haul somebody up. And in this case, you see we have a double safety going on there, but all of the work's being done by one person. So the ability for one or two people, a small team, to be able to raise somebody out of the situation that they're in, again, is very important. The other capability that's important is being able to do a rescue by rappel. And again, people have to be trained to do this, but it's not rocket science. Literally, somebody can lower down to somebody, clip into them with a single device, and get them off of their system, again, either by lifting them off their system or by cutting the scissors, and then simply rappel to the ground with them. And that usually happens, we usually try to prepare for that in a situation where there may be a bad medical situation going on, or there may have been trauma as a result of the fall. And again, simple. All of these things that you've just seen, there are multiple systems out there where this can be done with four devices. You have four pieces of equipment that are permanently rigged together. And all you do is go clip, clip, and then see what you're going to do. Raise, lower, cut, whatever it might be. Professional rescue considerations or medical considerations, you may end up needing to use a litter of some sort. You may need to end up packaging the patient to get him out of a vat or wherever he is. So being prepared to do that is something that you may or may not choose to do in-house. You may defer this to the professional rescue folks, and really it's not a whole lot different than what you just did and saw in the raising situation, except the person's in a litter instead of a harness. And again, this can be very, very simple. It doesn't have to be rocket science. So the key things are to be able to escape somehow, to be able to raise a person, to be able to lower a person, and to be able to rescued by rappel. So that's my brief answer to your question, is what kind of equipment should be in your kit, enough equipment and sufficient equipment to allow you to do all of those four things with as little equipment as possible. Training, again, remember these guys have a real job to do too, so you don't want to overtrain them, you don't want to overcomplicate their system. You need to consider initial training, practice, retraining, and documentation. So documentation is incredibly important and becoming more and more so from a regulatory standpoint. So encourage you to really take care of your training records. Who do you train? You train everybody. You train absolutely everyone who has the potential to fall at height. You train them at the very least in self-recovery. So getting into that position of comfort and potentially self-rescue, everybody gets trained in that. Who do you train in buddy rescue or the assisted rescue techniques? At least one group of people per shift. So you always have to have somebody on site who can do that job. This is the suspension trauma issue, a suspension intolerance issue, and this is just another example of how that system should be high. Whatever the system is that somebody steps into, it should be up high. But we've already talked about suspension intolerance a lot today, so I'm going to go ahead and blast past that. But I'd like to point out that retraining is incredibly important. This is from the National Training Labs in Bethel, Maine, and they say that as much as 70% of a person's knowledge is lost in a month. I mean, that's huge. That's really huge. So giving these guys chance to your buddy rescue guys every 6 months at a minimum is what we try to shoot for, and it doesn't need to take an entire shift. It can take an hour because the rescue itself shouldn't take more than about 15 minutes. If they're not doing it in 15 minutes, then they need to start over. So I encourage you to really consider your fall protection and rescue plan, your rescue plan as a part of your fall protection plan within the Comprehensive Managed Fall Protection Program. And I think in the long run, you'll see that it has a lot more benefits than it'll cost you. Simple, elegant solutions. If anybody has any questions, I'd love to entertain your questions. Does anybody have the time? 10:20. So we have a few minutes for questions. If anybody has any questions, yes, sir. This presentation is not on the disk. However, I have had it uploaded to a website where you can actually download it. It's in a flash, and she just sent me this morning the information on how it's been uploaded to. So I will look that up here and tell you where it is. But you're always welcome to give me a call and or email me, and I can also send you the link that way. The URL for the presentation is www.pmirope.com. So that right at the bottom there, pmirope.com/rescue-tv/presentation. So, sir? Yes, it's www.pmirope.com/rescue-tv/presentation. And again, if you want to email me or give me a call, I can send you the link as well if you have problems getting to it. Are there any other questions? If anybody would like to stay and chat afterwards, I'll be here for a few minutes. And other than that, I really appreciate your time today, and thanks for coming in.
Thank you for listening. This concludes the session. For information regarding other sessions in this series, please call Avon at 1-800-810-TAKE.